You have to participate in your own rescue. If you're not, and you're actually just like making my job harder, then what are we doing? You're not ready. Your credit isn't ready to be fixed yet. Come back when that has changed.
Are you ready to revolutionize your credit repair business? Welcome to Credit Repair Junkies, the ultimate podcast for credit repair entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Bruce Politano, seven-figure serial entrepreneur and author. Each week, we'll dive deep into battle-tested strategies, uncover the latest industry breakthroughs, and reveal insider tips that will put your business light years ahead of the competition. If you're ready to grow your credit repair business, head to creditrepairjunkies.com/go to watch my free training.
What's going on, credit junkies? Bruce Politano here, Chief Credit Junkie. And today I have my good friend, Dustin Ball from Rocket Financial, joining me once again. And we're going to have such an awesome conversation today. Dustin, thank you for joining me, brother.
You know what? Thank you for having me back. It was a lot of fun last time. There were a lot of people that messaged me and said, man, what a just educational talk we had last time, right? And you know how it is when you get together, we talk about pretty much everything, you know? So I'm glad to do it. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Fair warning. Anytime that Dustin and I get together and we talk, it's not for 20 minutes. So yeah. I don't know how long this episode is going to be. It could be a 30 minute episode or it could be an hour long episode. I don't know. What I know for a fact is that I'm not going to cut this short because I know we're going to talk about some really good stuff today. So let's jump right into it, right? So
yep.
The episode today is geared, I want to say, more towards established credit repair companies. But if you are brand new and you're just getting started and you are consuming this content that we're talking about today, you're going to be really further ahead in your credit repair business once you get the ball rolling, right? But for those of you who've been running your credit repair company for a few months or a few years, today you want to tune in, you want to pay attention because we're going to be talking about debt defense. So when we get into debt defense, let's define that, Dustin. What is debt defense?
When I started my credit repair company, right, remember it was kind of right there in the beginning of COVID. And so there was a, you know, year and a half period where I didn't see any any clients getting sued. No one was getting sued for any debt or anything like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, COVID kind of went away and everyone sort of got back to normal. And then clients started getting sued like crazy. And it was Midland Financial and Portfolio and Santander was suing a lot of folks. And debt defense is basically just what has to happen. The process of a client, right, at that point, who would be a defendant that has gotten sued by a creditor or by a debt collector, the process that they need to go through that is either going to go to court, go to arbitration, come to a settlement, or what have you, right? Because the last thing, there are a lot of options that they have at that point. What they most often do is just don't go to court, right, which is literally every other option they have is better than that one. You know, and so debt defense is something that I think, like you said, there. If you're an established credit repair company, this is something that you have gone through. Like one of your clients has gotten sued, right? And it's not that credit repair gets you sued. It just happens to be that our clientele is our clientele because a lot of them, for one reason or another, were unable to pay their bills, right? That's not a judgment call. It's not a morality call. COVID messed around and messed up a lot of folks, right? So. But for some reason, they weren't able to satisfy their debts, and the debt collectors decided to take them to court, right? And so everyone has seen it.
So, you know, to bring it all the way to the beginning of what this whole thing, even how does this all even come to play, right?
Sure.
I think that a lot of CROs, especially the newer ones, they don't understand that when you remove a debt from somebody's credit report through credit repair, it doesn't mean that you're removing the obligation of that debt being paid. When a debt is removed from the credit report, it's simply removed from the credit report. It's like you're hiding the skeletons in the closet. So when the next lender pulls a credit report, they won't see that account, that collection, that charge off, that late payment. They won't see that on there, right? But the creditor that you owe that money to, they still know you owe that debt. So it doesn't remove you from the obligation of paying the debt. It just removes the reporting of the debt from your credit report. So no one's going to see it. I see it all the time. Oh, $30,000. I removed $20,000 worth of debt from my client's credit and blah, blah, blah. Yes, you did remove $30,000 worth of debt from your client's credit.
But that's not how they say it.
Life.
They
right?
say, I deleted $30,000 worth of debt from this client. No. Yeah. No. No,
you didn't. Report,
yeah. Right?
So now the client, you know, for the lack of education, thinks they're free from that debt.
Absolutely.
You
know,
the $15,000 medical bill or the $20,000 charge off from Santander, right? We got that off the credit report. They're like, I'm good. I don't need to worry about this anymore. Lo and behold, served with a summons, right? And then, so this is like how this whole thing even originates is there is a legal contract. You have a legal obligation to pay your debt. So when you apply for an account and you go through that application process and all the fine print that's in there, like you are agreeing to pay this debt back. And if you don't, there is a clause in there that allows the creditor to come after you for their money, to sue you for their money, right? And you mentioned like a lot of people will receive that summons or they receive that letter in the mail saying that they have to go to court and they ignore it. They just put it on their kitchen
table.
That's
exactly what they want you to do.
They don't show up to court and then default judgment, right?
Right. That's exactly what they want you to do.
So what happens at that point? So let's talk about what happens when you do it the wrong way. And then we can talk about, okay, what is a better way or maybe a right way to handling it, right? Because from my experience, right, we work with thousands of clients every single day. We know that when our clients get those letters, the first thing they do is like, what do we do? And then right. The CROs, they may not necessarily know how to best advise them on what to do. And then what happens?
So your comment right there, that CROs don't necessarily know. That's exactly how I got into like this kind of research because I'm a nerd. I don't like not having a ready answer for things that happen, right? I hate it. And what really got me, this really blew me away is that, and you know me, like I know a lot of CROs, right? I've got people like you. I've got people that have been in credit repair a lot longer than me. And as I was learning, right? And this was years in the making as I was learning and as I was trying to figure out what needed to happen, the same answer came up literally every single time, which was just tell them to get a lawyer, right? That was it. Like every CRO has this recycled on repeat answer because no one is talking about what a client needs to do. And I'm not saying that you need to be a paralegal or you need to guide them on this, and you actually better not, right? Because there is, you know, unlicensed practice of law, and that, you know, UPL is a big deal. But if you don't even know what they're about to go through, right, then you can't give them any sort of confidence that they're going to be able to handle it.
Yeah, myself right? included. Like, if I'm being honest, whenever our clients, you know, tell us they're being sued, like, all we tell them is like, look, unfortunately, I'm not an attorney. Like, I can't help with any legal matters.
Right.
I recommend you find an attorney in your area that can help you with this. And not that that's necessarily bad advice. It's better advice than me trying to tell them what to do. And I don't know what to do. But there's better things that you can do to help your client, right?
I think. Well, and so I think the first thing that you need to be able to do is just give them the confidence to know, like, hey, well, they're not, you know, this isn't going to kill you. They're not going to throw you in jail. Right. They're not going to come and try to take your house or take your car or anything like that. This is the outgrowth. Like there's going to be a negotiation process and you might even take them to trial, but you have options here and all of them, no matter what happens, all of them are going to be better than ignoring it. Right. But that's exactly how I got into it was, you know, by looking around and talking to folks that have been in this industry a lot longer than me, right. That I've learned a lot from. No one was even, the answer was just talk to a lawyer. Well, they're not actually looking to you for legal advice. They're not looking to you for you to get into like case law with them and all that kind of stuff. They just want to know like, hey, what am I about to walk into? Right. What am I about to walk into? Are they going to clap me in irons and take me away in front of my kids and all that kind of stuff? What's about to happen? And that's kind of where my research started was, okay, well, what does this process actually look like? And so the very first thing I figured out was really kind of how the other side worked, how the plaintiff side worked, right? Which is they want you to not go to court.
Right. Plaintiff meaning the creditor that's suing the customer.
Yeah, that's the plaintiff. Is the creditor, the debt collector. Specifically, that is it's the account that hired the lawyer that filed the lawsuit against the client, right? Against the defendant, right? And we can just call them the client and this guy the other side, right? That lawyer has not gotten paid a dime. Nothing. Debt collection law is not. It's not sexy by any stretch of the imagination. It's not super profitable, right? There, if you know, this is kind of one of those things. Like, if you were, you don't go through, you know, 4 years of college, 3 years of law school, clerking all these different places to go and do something like debt collection law, right? So a lot of times the firms that are doing this or the lawyers that are doing this are not going to be like your top-notch kind of thing, right? The reason they take this on is because most of the time the firm will have a like a regional contract with a debt collector, right, or a creditor, and they'll be able to file 100 or more of these lawsuits all at the same time, right? And so,
so they're not picking and choosing one.
No,
like you miss a client, they didn't pay the debt, so no,
they don't know you. They're not suing you.
Yeah, when debt collectors buy debt, they buy in bulk. When debt collectors sue, they sue in bulk as
well. They sue in bulk, right?
You know, there's a misconception that I hear all the time too that the client will get mad at the credit repair company and think that they're getting sued because the credit repair company did something. It's like, oh, you know, you disputed this and, you know, you, now I'm getting sued. It's like, no. You're getting sued regardless if we had done anything or not. Like, this isn't a problem. Like, these debt collectors, they're not holding a grudge against you. They're not like a sleeping bear that just got poked with a dispute and now they're awake and they want to come eat you. Right. So if this, you were going to get sued regardless if we were working together or not, like this was coming. It just happened that it came while we were doing this. Is
right.
that correct?
It's what it, I mean, it's kind of when you see the, like those Venn diagrams that overlap.
Yeah.
Right? This is the, you know, when you got people that don't pay their bills. Right. And you got people that, you know, would need help with their credit. Right. There's going to be that swath in the middle that meets up. And that's what happens. Like, people don't get sued for credit repair. People that don't pay their bills need credit repair. And those are also the type of people that get sued. You don't get sued for paying your bills. You know, for the most part, you don't need credit repair when you're actively paying your bills, right? And again, that's not a, it's not a morality judgment or anything like that. Since COVID, all of us have had a lot of clients that would have never needed us before COVID. Right. The game has definitely changed. And look at me, like I've got CEOs, I've got doctors, I've got lawyers, I've got a ton of mortgage lenders that are in my program. Right. They know about credit. Things happen. OK, so it's not like no one has ever gotten sued because of credit repair. You know, no one's ever gotten sued for a debt because they were going through credit repair for a debt that they didn't owe.
Yeah. It's not because you send like a you know,
dispute letter,
a validation letter, or whatever, and all of a sudden now you're going to get sued. You know,
no.
And I think that credit repair, most people who I consider to be qualified clients for credit repair are clients who maybe struggled in the past for whatever reason, they lost their job or COVID or whatever, and now they're no longer struggling and they're ready to get their life back in order. For me, that's a qualified credit repair client. Now, if the client was struggling, is still struggling, like I'm looking at your credit report and you have like late payments from like this month or last month on multiple accounts, I'm sorry, Mr. or Mrs., you don't seem like you're a good fit for credit repair right now because you're still damaging your credit while I'm trying to fix it. And, you know, we can't overstep on each other here. So I think a good when do you know if you're ready for credit repair? When you're ready to pay your bills on time moving forward and you're ready to do something to try to fix the mistakes of the past.
Right. I absolutely agree with you. And I've actually had this, sadly, I've had this discussion with other CROs and in like public forums. And not everyone feels that way. You know, I definitely feel like you that, you know, this is not a, you know, this is not a luxury for you. Right. And I'll tell clients on the consultation, like, hey, you know, you're going to be in the program for a year, right? You need to just make friends with that. And you may not be, it may be a little less, it may be a little bit more, but you need to understand the time commitment. You also need to understand the financial commitment, right? You need to know that however long you're in the program, you're paying the program fee, right? We don't want to be your last $125, $150 every month. And if we're helping you get your pay down calculator and all that kind of stuff. If we see that we're your last thing, then we might tell you that this is just not the time for you. And the reason it's not that you can't make it, it's that life happens.
Yeah.
Right. You're going to, kids are going to get hurt.
A lot of these clients, like they see credit repair as a bill. Credit repair is not a bill. Credit repair is an investment, right? And you don't invest money that you don't have. Like, I can't be investing here and then not paying my light bill here.
Every financial planner in the world would tell you that, like, hey, the first thing, if you can't pay your bills, then you don't need to be buying crypto.
Right? Exactly.
Or you don't need to be whatever. Like, you got to take care of this first.
Exactly.
And that's what I'll tell them. Like, life happens. Like, one of your kids is going to fall down or your tire is going to pop or whatever. And we're not going to be the thing that you have to decide whether you're going to pay us or put food on your table. So if we're, you know, if we're your last little chunk of money at the end of the month, then this is probably just not the right time for you. And that's not a judgment call. We're taking care of you.
Exactly. And when a client sees and they understand that this credit repair payment is an investment into their financial future, they're more likely to stick with the program and do their part. And, you know, a good friend of mine, he says this all the time. He says, look, you have to participate in your own rescue. I'm just here, you know, I'm extending a hand, but brother, you got to reach up and grab my arm so that we can pull you out. Like, you have to participate in your own rescue. If you're not, and you're actually just like making my job harder, then what are we doing? We're spinning our wheels. Like, we shouldn't be have this working relationship right now. You're not ready. Your credit isn't ready to be fixed yet. Come back when that has changed.
Once you grow, like, and if you've been in the industry for a while and you've kind of grown, then you understand that, because A, you're going to have, not only are you going to have a lot more of a headache, you know, if you're trying to collect payments and all this kind of stuff. But at the same time, like, once you get your 100 clients, 200 clients, 500 clients, whatever, you realize that, you know what, I'm not taking care of these people, and I'm going to make my job a whole lot harder if I'm taking on anybody, anyone that wants it. If they're above a 3 on the jerk scale or whatever, right, during the consultation, then they're probably going to be like that during the
whole year that they're with you. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, and so, you know, that's the goal. Like, goal number one for a credit repair company is grow to the point where you don't have to take on anybody, right? You don't got to take on just everybody, you know, and you can, like you said, you can be more realistic about who you take on, because this is going to be a realistic thing for you.
That's true. And in the early days, you can still, you know, you hear that beggars can't be choosers, right? But this is a business that you're running.
Sure.
Okay. So at the end of the day, there are bills in your business that need to get taken care of, and there are responsibilities. You got to put food on your table, and there's all of that. So if you're just getting started, maybe you will bring on some of these people that are an 8 on a jerk scale, right? Because their dollars are worth just as much as the dollars of the guy that's a 0 on a jerk scale, right? But you're right, you do get to a point in business where your business has grown enough to where you don't have to accept that, right? You don't, like, I don't have to eat, you know, the worst kind of steak. I can have the filet or the ribeye, but at some point you're still going to want to eat because you need food in your tummy, you know? With your business the same way, you need to feed your business anything that it can, but you're going to get to a point where you can feed your business a little bit more higher quality type of food, right? Which is those customers.
Well, at the same point, like, you know,
horrible analogy, by the way, like,
I don't think necessarily. Like, I started my company, I was $89 a month. Right. And
I'm still $89 a month, 5,000 active clients later.
So for me, like, I was, and I'm not much over that. I'm 125, you know, plus credit monitoring, but what you kind of realize, like, there's kind of sort of a continuum, right? The more expensive you are, the better your client is, right? I've had CEOs say, hey, I will give you $5,000, right? $5,000, you know, and just work it till it's done. And I didn't take it because I don't do that. But, like, that guy would have been a great client. You know, he would have done whatever I told him to do, you know, because he's, you know, that for him, that understands that it's an investment. I think that at any price point, there's going to be people that just, you know, just aren't ready to hear that that there's going to be things that they need to do. You know, they're not going to be people that want to participate in their own rescue, and they're going to say, you know, wake me up when it's at 7:50. You know, or something's going to happen and they get sued and it's going to be your fault, and they're not going to understand.
Correct.
That this is the ultimate repercussion of whether it's, you know, cognizant responsibility, like they knew that they, you know, were racking up all this money and not paying it, or it was some sort of other issue. Maybe they got sick and couldn't work for months or whatever, but this is the ultimate outgrowth of that.
Yeah.
Right.
I have a private one-on-one coaching client of mine, and we talk about this all the time, the quality over quantity. Okay.
Yeah.
This guy charges $300 a month for credit repair. Now, if you're in a credit repair industry and you're charging $300 a month, you're on a higher end of credit repair. Right. But I was, you know, I'm helping him, you know, kind of rebuild his back end and all this stuff. And I'm asking him, like, you know, how many, you know, do your clients call you? Like, how many, you know, customer service phone calls do you guys handle on a monthly basis? Like, our clients don't call us. Like, his clients are like, you tell us what you need. And if I don't hear from you, I assume everything's good. They don't have any sort of headaches at all with $300 a month clients. Right. Me on my end, I'm an $89 a month credit repair company, and our clients will call us maybe once or twice every single week So there's a difference in quality over quantity, and there's no right or wrong answer. Like, I'm not sitting here trying to tell him, no. You know, do you understand that you'd have 20 times as many clients as you have now if you charge 89? He's like, I don't care. Like, I also don't have 20 times the amount of headaches that you do, you know? So you got to pick and choose. At some point, are you going to keep going for quantity, or do you want to start increasing quality of the clients that you're working with and that you're dealing with?
And, you know, price isn't going to be the ultimate decider there, right? There's some people that can pay $300 that could still be jerks. You know, there's going to be some people that, you know, would pay $89 because that's really all they can afford. That would be great clients because they understand how much that they need it, and they're willing to do whatever it takes, right? You know, so price isn't just that. It's more going to be about like, hey, you know, are you being diligent on your consultation, or are you only, is your consultation for you only a sales call? Because if it's just a sales call, then the only thing that you're looking at is, you know, what can I do to get you in this car today?
You know? And you're also looking at a customer as just a dollar sign. You're not looking at them as a human who needs your help, who has goals and aspirations for a future, right?
That's it. Yeah. And so if you look at it more as a consultation, and I start all of my consultations, literally all of them, I let them know this. Hey, I know I've told you this. I want to reiterate this to you. This is not a sales call. Okay, this is a consultation. My job is just to help you figure out where you are with your credit and help you make some action steps on what you might need to do to get it where you want it to be. Right now, we are a company that helps people improve their credit. If I think that our services might be something that'll help you out, I'll let you know. If not, I'll let you know that too. Right. So don't think that I'm going to try to sell you on anything. I'm trying to figure out what will be the best fit for you. And if that's us, then we can talk about that. But don't think that this is automatically going to lead there. Right. I let them know. And they really appreciate that. And that really sets the tone because they're much more open with whatever we're talking about.
Yeah. Right. You build instant trust.
Right. They're not as guarded. And it's very obvious. I turn away at least as many people as I take on, because they actually don't need my program, right? They need to change some things here or there, or I'll let them know that they're not ready. This is what you need to do. This is what you know. You need to get your balances down. You need to get back to where you've made nothing but great payments for the last 4 to 6 months, and this is where we're at, right? Then you can come back on, because like you said, if you've got late payments all the way up to this month on your credit report. Now's not the time. Like, you got to take care of home first.
That's true. Man, we went on a little tangent there.
It always happens.
Like, I have like 32 other things in my brain that I want to talk about. It's not for today. Let's go on to the debt defense thing. So we talked about how it happens, right? Like, it all starts because clients will not pay. They don't pay their bills. They're miseducated and misguided on the debt got removed from the credit report. So now they think they're free from it. And then next thing you know, it always starts with a summons, right? So what is that process of the creditor generating that summons and the customer receiving that summons? So the plaintiff defendant process for the summons. How is it created and how is it delivered?
So the creditor has really nothing to do with that summons. What they do is they take just a crate of files, right? They just send them down to whatever law firm they've got a contract with in your region, right? Because if you're being sued, it has to be a local lawyer, because they've got to be registered in your state, because you're going to go to court in your state, right? You're not going to go to federal court or anything like that. They're going to take you to court in your city, basically. Right. So you're going to go to either the city or the county court where you live. So the lawyer is going to be local. And this is to your advantage later. Like, we'll discuss this later on, but this is to your advantage. But the lawyer has to be licensed in your state. That means that if they can't have a contract with the same firm nationwide, because most firms don't have lawyers that are willing to sue a bunch of folks that are licensed in every state. Right. It's very rarely are you going to find a lawyer that is licensed in more than two or three states. Right. Most are licensed in two. If you're in Texas or Florida or California or a larger state, you might only be licensed in that state. But there are other states like up in the Northeast where they might be licensed in multiple states because everything is like right there. Right. But the lawyer has to be licensed there. The lawyer at that point will then basically just file a bunch of complaints. And a complaint is just a description of what you did or what they're claiming that you did. They're required to tell you a little bit about the debt, about who, you know, who the creditor is and what you're being sued for. And they file it down at the county clerk or the court clerk. And then you get issued, then they issue a summons, right? Now at that point, the summons is going to tell you that you need to do one of two things. Okay.
Let's back up for a second. So the lawyers, the law firm goes to the court, files a complaint.
Right.
Hey, you know, this guy has not paid this debt. We're legally allowed to collect on
it. It's not a criminal complaint either. That's something else that, you know, this is just civil. It's not criminal.
Okay. Got it. So they will file that civil complaint against the person. Hey, they owe us money. We can't collect. Help.
Right.
Right. We're legally allowed to pursue something here. So then the court will then issue a summons. And that summons, they just throw it in the client's name mailbox?
Usually not. Okay. Well, no, they can't just put it in your mailbox. Every jurisdiction is allowed to have kind of their own rules, but they're all generally the same, right? There are going to be a few jurisdictions around the country that says that it can be mailed, but it's always going to have to be mailed certified with a return receipt and an actual signature. Okay, so it can't just be mailed. You're not just going to find it in your mailbox. Like, it's going to be presented to you by the post office guy, you know, or through FedEx or whatever. It's going to be tracked, and that it has to be tracked because there's going to be a certificate of service that has to be filed with the court, right? Whether they're serving you or whether you're responding to a motion or whatever, there's always going to have to be a certificate of service that says that the service was official, it was proper, and that has to be filed with the court, right? That said, there are a ton of people out there that got sued, didn't show up to court because they didn't get properly served, and they got a judgment against them. And the first time that they find out that they got sued is when they get a paycheck on Friday morning. They wake up, they know it's payday, so they check their bank account right away, and it's less than it ought to be. They go to HR, they go, you know, what's going on? And HR says your wages have been garnished. That's the first thing that they know, is that their wages got garnished. They had no idea they got sued.
That's horrible.
It happens all the time, right? And the reason being is, debt collectors and lawyers are jerks, and they don't do their due diligence.
Would you say they're like a 7 or 8 on a jerk scale? Like, what would you?
Man, it depends on the lawyer. I would say same thing with like cops, right? In general, I think cops are good people, right? And, you know, I don't want to say that cops are bad, you know, but you fit the description. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know,
there are bad apples everywhere.
Right, right. So there are some lawyers I think that will take, and the lawyers normally know the judges, right? They're very cozy with the judges. And that's not to say that there's always any like backdoor dealings or anything like that. But as soon as you file a lawsuit, it's going to get assigned to a judge, and you're going to know, the lawyer is going to know what that judge's kind of his personality is like, or her personality. You know, and so they're going to know what they can get away with and what, you know, what may be able to slide. What happens a lot of times is that people just move, right? A lot of people that have credit issues or have bill paying issues, they're generally transient, right? They're not staying in the same place for a lot of time. They usually don't own their house, you know, and so they're moving a lot. And the debt collector doesn't have your new address, right? They have whatever address is on file. Now, this doesn't help that most people, when they move, they don't update their address with the DMV. You know, this happens. I literally see this every day when I'm taking on new clients, is this guy's lived in this house for 2 years and he still has his old address on there. So that happens as well, because all they're really required to do in some areas is to attempt to serve you at the address that they have on file. Right. This is the address. This is the legal address. Now, technically, they're supposed to do their due diligence. And, you know, because you can. Utility companies are public records, right? Different things like that. Yeah. They're public records, and they're supposed to be able to do their due diligence tracking you down. Now, most of the time, that does not happen. I have never known of a case to where someone went back and tried to remove a judgment because they were improperly served, and the lawyer was able to say, like, no, we looked up all the public records. You know, we looked up all this. This was the address that was correct. Right. I've never seen that happen. Like, I've never seen them be able to provide proof that they actually did their due diligence in locating the correct address. So they will. Right. A lot of times they'll take it to whatever the address is. Someone will open the door. They'll slap it in their hand. It's not the same person. It could be a kid. You know, and I've seen that too. Like it's handed to a kid. That's not allowed. You know, in some jurisdictions, they're allowed to hand it to someone that lives there that says, yes, this person lives here and I'll hand it to them. Like if you're married, they hand it to your husband or they hand it to your wife or something like that. And that person technically is responsible for it. But there's a reasonable, they've got the reasonable expectation that will get to you. Right. They should not be able to just I've known cases that they just stuck it in the door, you know, that kind of thing. But
like the little sticker from UPS that you got to come get your thing.
Right. Yeah. They'll just stick it in your door, stuff like that. And at that point, like the judge is not going to assume if the lawyer comes in and they say it was properly served. Right. Just like the credit bureaus. If the credit bureaus get a data packet from a creditor and they're not out there seeing if this payment was actually late or not. Right. It's being reported to them. They take it as it is, right? They don't do an investigation until someone says something about it. Same thing with the judge. Like the judge has
and even their investigation is just to ask. They just ask, right?
Right.
Hey, is this late? Yep. Okay, great. Investigation complete.
The judge, if they get a certificate of service, right, and it says, you know, it was properly served, that's what they're gonna go by.
Now, can the defendant defend themselves and say, I've never seen this in my life?
Absolutely.
Like, I haven't lived there in 12 years. And so what's the process there?
At that point, A, they've found out somehow that they got sued. Normally it's going to be because their wages have been garnished, right?
Or they're selling a house and title comes back that there's a lien.
That there's a lien or something like that. And not a lot of states will. There are some states that are like six that don't allow wage garnishments for debt, right? Texas is one of them. They don't allow wage garnishments for debt. They can put a levy on your bank account. Right. Just because they can't garnish your wages doesn't mean they can't. Everyone's like, oh, I'm judgment proof. No. Like if you've got a bank account or you've got property, then, you know, your bank account can have a lien put on it. They could lock you out of your bank account. You know, your house could have a lien on it. Your car could have a lien on it. That could be, you know, wildly inconvenient.
And to explain what the bank levy is, that's where they can take the money that's in the account. And then any money that gets deposited, they can take that too.
All of it.
They'll get you dry.
Right. Like you, I mean, at that point, you would rather have your wages garnished because there's a limit.
That's true.
I mean, it's
like 15 to 25% or something like that.
The federal limit, maximum federal limit that federal allow is 25%, except for like taxes. Like if you've got like tax liens or something like that, then they can get you for like half for a garnishment. Right. But in general, right, if it's just a debt, the general limit is 25%. And then you could still negotiate that, right? If you say that, like, hey, this is where my expenses are, right? This income is exempt, right? There are certain incomes that are exempt and things like that. You could get it down to a lot less, right? But at that point, you can still negotiate with the creditor. You know, but if someone is getting their wages garnished and they didn't know about it, then there are a couple things they need to do, right?
So this is like worst best case scenario. Worst best case scenario is you got sued and you're already in the hole because they already took action because of the judgment and they
didn't know it
against you.
Right.
So let's say they now garnish your wages or levy your bank account. This is worst case scenario, but how can we make this better? Like how will the consumer navigate from here?
It happens a lot. Most people don't realize that there are things that you can do. There are really a ton of things that you can do, because if you were improperly served, meaning they didn't actually properly serve you, and they cannot prove that they did, and they cannot prove that they took
payments. Even if they have the certificate.
Oh, yeah. Like if you can say, like, I haven't lived there in 2 years, how did you serve me there? Like, this is when I moved. These are my leases, you know, that kind of thing. At that point, immediately the judge is going to stay the garnishment, right? The other half of that is that now you are participating in the lawsuit, right? Now you know about it. So there's
stay means they'll pause the wage garnishment.
They will stay the way they'll pause it, right? And if it is found that the judgment was rendered. Basically, the judge gave a summary judgment based on improper service where there was unethical things. Then there could be a counter suit. There could be repercussions against the lawyer, but you can also get all your money back, right? So if there's been several weeks that you've been garnished or several months, that can get all your money back. Now, what you have to do at that point is.
And the consumer can do all of this without an attorney.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
Which we're going to, you know, foreshadowing here at the end of this podcast episode. Thus is going to give you guys a place where you can go and get a bunch of these resources that can teach you if you're a CRO and you if you're a consumer on how to do all this stuff that we're talking about yourself without having to hire an attorney.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you the reason why I did this is that my one, information is not out there. Like when I started looking for this, it's just not there, right? There's no resource. There's no book. There's no website that you can go to that just explains the process of defending yourself in a debt collection lawsuit. Most people would say, go get a lawyer. Throughout the resources that I've created, I'll say, it's always a good idea to have a lawyer, right? Not everyone can afford a lawyer. And lawyers are really good at like throwing out a ton of paperwork and all this kind of stuff. If you hire a lawyer, they're getting paid by the hour, right? That's not always the case. You know, if the lawyer sees it and there could be like counterclaims and things like that, then they'll take it on contingency because of the counterclaims, right? This is one of those examples. Like if your wages are being garnished, you didn't get served properly, right? You can go and get a defense attorney. And that could be a countersuit where they'll take your case on contingency because they're going to get paid on the improper service. But it's almost kind of skewed against the consumer because these lawyers are doing it for free, knowing that they're going to get 90% of these cases above 95% just don't show up to court. And so imagine if every debt is $5,000. Right. That's the standard. Well, if they get a summary judgment, it's going to be for every dollar that they claim that you owe. The judge is not going to force them to verify that debt amount is correct. You know, they could inflate it. They could add all kinds of interest and fees and attorney's fees and things like that that are not listed in your contract.
That's crazy.
It happens all the time. Right. And so if a summary judgment comes, the judges are going to ask for like a full accounting and a breakdown of all the fees. Right. They're assuming that you're not here in court because you chose not to fight this lawsuit because you know that you're guilty. Right. So they're going to issue a summary judgment for the entire amount. And then normally some time will go past. Right. The judgment has been entered into public record, and then they're going to come back and they're going to get permission to garnish your wages. Right. Because there's a whole process that has to happen there, but they don't have to inform you of that. That just happens between the lawyer and the judge. Right. Or really. Yeah, that's it. The lawyer is just going to submit all the garnishment requests to the county clerk. County clerk is going to just pass them over to the judge. It's going to stamp them, you know, send them right back. And now you have access to their wages. Right. If the human resources department at your job gets a judge signed garnishment request, that money is going to them, period.
It's funny, though. They don't know where you live, but they know where you work.
Right? Oh, yeah. They know where you work. Right. They know where you bank, you know, and that's the thing is
that can't find your current address, but I know where your parking spot is at your job.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. 68 over there under the tree. That's where he parks. But so if this happens and it happens a lot. Right. I would say 50% of the people that I talked to, they had no idea that they got served. Right. The other 50% are, I just got served. What the heck? You know, but the other 50% are saying, like, I didn't even know that I was getting sued. You know, I thought I might get sued at some point because I had a lot of debt out there, but I never got sued or anything like that.
So what do you recommend somebody do that they got sued and regardless if action is already being taken against them, like a wage garnishment or levy or not, like they got the default judgment against them. What do you recommend a person in that position do at this point?
Very first thing is don't panic, right? Do not panic. The second thing they need to do is start documenting everything. They need to document when they found out about the garnishment, how much is being garnished, right? What percentage of it is. They need to look at the garnishment order that your HR will have. That's actually supposed to be given to you as well. That will have the court that it came out of. It will have the debt collector on it, and it will have the total amount. So they need to start collecting all the documentation they can about the garnishment and finding out about the judgment, right? And that could be also going down and either going down to the county clerk itself, right? Or going to just emailing the county clerk, finding out where they can email the county clerk and getting whatever garnishment order there was, whatever the judgment is. They could also go into PACER, right? You can get a free PACER account and look up your name in the county records and figure out who sued you and all that kind of stuff.
Because it's public records at this point,
right,
the judgment.
It's public records, yeah. Right? And you're going to have to pay, you know, $2 or $3 once you get in there, because every PACER lookup is a, you know, is 50 cents or whatever it is. But that'll give you all that information. And at that point, what you need to do is file
PACER, P-A-C-E-R.
P-A-C-E-R. And P-A-C-E-R. All PACER is, if you're a newer CRO or you're a consumer and you don't know what that is, that is where all public records from every court in the country get entered. It is the legal database that every hearing, every everything that happens in court gets entered into PACER. Okay.
It's like a credit bureau for public judgments.
Kind of, yeah. Like there are
it's a database for public judgment.
And it doesn't even have to be public judgment. If there is a court record, right? If something happens, if you sue somebody and then dismiss it 5 minutes later, the fact that it happened is in PACER, right? It's basically the public record of all things that happen in all courts in every court in the country. Right. Yeah. It's there.
We'll go on a little tangent here again. So a lot of CROs, you know, with dispute bankruptcies,
sure,
from a credit report, right? And then, you know, real popular method out there is you dispute with the credit bureaus. Hey, you know, please verify that this bankruptcy belongs to me. And then the credit bureau will respond, verified. So then you go to the courthouse because the credit bureaus are listing the courthouse as a data furnisher on the credit report. So you as a CRO send a letter to the courthouse saying, hey, do you verify information or dispute or, you know, submit information to the credit bureaus regarding my bankruptcy?
Absolutely
not. They respond, no, we don't. So then you send that to the credit bureaus like, hey, TransUnion, you said you got this from the courthouse. Here's a paperwork from the courthouse saying they don't give you jack squat. You need to remove this from our credit report immediately.
That's right.
And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Or then,
sure,
you know, oh, we'll dispute it with LexisNexis because LexisNexis has all that information. But in reality, the credit bureaus are getting this information PACER, right? Like a lot of this public record stuff that they get, you know, even LexisNexis might be getting it from PACER, or PACER just, they'll furnish that data to whoever's going to go out there and look for it, right?
Yeah. So LexisNexis, LCI, right? Both have access to PACER, right? LCI is who, since 2019, has given bankruptcy information to TransUnion. Since 2019, it's been LCI up in Washington or something like that. Other than that, it is LexisNexis where they get public record information. Right. And what folks are doing is really this kind of like, pardon my friend, it's kind of like this half-assed way of doing it. Because if you actually go and look in PACER, like if as a CRO, you actually just go and get a PACER account, you can look up the bankruptcy. Right. And you can actually see if what is reported in PACER is reported correctly at LexisNexis. And if you can see if it is reported correctly at the credit bureaus. And that's the step that no one takes. But that's actually how you get bankruptcies off. Because most of the time, right now, you gotta. It's almost like a game of telephone. It went down the line. It goes from PACER, then it goes to LexisNexis or LCI, then it goes to the credit bureaus. There's going to be something there that is not correct, and they're not going to go back and correct it because this is what they've got, right? And if you can prove that it is different than what is actually in PACER, then that stuff will go away immediately. Right. And that's
because it's inaccurately reported. And that's what the FCRA says. If it's inaccurate, unverifiable, cannot be reported. So that's why it comes off.
That's right. You know, and the credit bureaus aren't going to call PACER. You know, there's no direct connection there. They can only send an ACVV, the affidavit that they send back and forth to a creditor or really a reporter. Right. A Metro 2 reporter, whoever is subscribing to be able to report to the credit bureaus, they can only send ACVV back and forth through those subscribers, right? So they have no relationship with PACER. They have no relationship with the court. So they can't send your request to PACER. They can't send it to the court like they can with a creditor or debt collector. And if you actually take the step to get the PACER report and you find those discrepancies and you present that to the credit bureau, then that bankruptcy is coming off, right? It doesn't matter if it's at LCI. It doesn't matter if it is at LexisNexis.
The source.
Right.
You went to the source of the information and like, hey, I got it from, you know, the horse's mouth right here that this isn't correct. This isn't accurate.
Absolutely. Reporting it, right? And for us at that point, like we don't even go back to LexisNexis. You know, like we'll go back to LexisNexis after it's removed from the credit bureaus. Right. Because then you want it, especially if they're trying to get a mortgage or what have you, then you want it removed from LexisNexis. Right. But you want to go to the credit bureaus first. You don't want to give LexisNexis the time to update it. You go to the credit bureaus and say, hey, you said this is verified. You know, you're supposed to do your due diligence. I even asked you how you verified it. You know, and here this is the PACER report saying that you lied.
And even on the mortgage ones, you know, you remove the bankruptcy from the client's experience using an Equifax report. This is great. And most mortgage companies will not give you a mortgage if you have a bankruptcy within the last 2 years, right? So Mr. Client has a bankruptcy from, you know, a year ago, and he's applying for a mortgage. He enrolls into credit repair. The credit repair company removes the bankruptcy from the client's credit report, but the mortgage company still knows about it because they also have access to this other report called CAVERS.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So they also have CAVERS. That's another place that you get like your student loan, wage garnishment things. Like if you have defaulted student loans, bankruptcies, yeah. If you have judgments, they don't show up on credit reports anymore.
Judgments, not since 2017. Yeah.
But they will be in CAVERS.
Oh, yes.
Right. So, that's another misconception where a lot of CROs are like, yeah, you're good to go apply for the mortgage now. And then a client applies for the mortgage, like, wait, I thought you removed bankruptcy. It's not there. Yeah, but we're not getting it from those data centers, experiences in Equifax. We're getting it from.
But CROs, right? Don't know that. Like, there's a lot of CROs. I mean, 90% of CROs out there, if you said that word, like if you said that database, they'd be like, huh? You know, they don't know, you know, and
it's not your fault, dude, because there's not a lot of people like you and I who are sitting here trying to just educate CROs just because we want to, not because they're trying to get into their wallet.
Right. It's an experience thing, right? We all had to learn about it at some point, you know. Hopefully you don't learn about it because you tell a client they're good to go and they go down there and it gets pulled up. Right. And you know, the really bad thing about it is the only time that they pull it is pre-close. That's it. Like, they're not pulling it when they give you your pre-approval letter.
Pre-approval.
Right? Nope. They're not doing that. Like, it's at close. Like, that's...
You're excited. About to get the keys.
Right. And they're about you're at the title company. They're about to slide those keys over to you. Right? That last thick sheaf of paperwork that they go through, that's when they're pulling all those reports. Right? And that's when it'll come up. And which has to be the worst feeling in the world.
I can imagine.
Right? I mean, not only for the consumer. You know, as a consumer,
deposit back, you're screwed. Like, you're bad.
Man, like, if you care about your clients at all and that happens, you know, I would feel awful, awful, you know? So that's kind of like the roundabout way of how a lot of that gets there. When a client does that, what we've talked about, you know, they can go in there and they can look in PACER, they can find it. That is their due diligence. They need to do as much as possible. Now, not everyone will do that. Not everyone will go and look up public records and all that kind of stuff, but you really don't even have to, right? All you have to do is, and there's a motion, and we talked a little bit earlier that I've created some resources, I have, but you could also, you can probably find one of these at SoloSuit or whatever. It is it's basically a motion to stay the judgment and the garnishment because of improper service, right? A motion to vacate the judgment and the garnishment due to improper service. And the one that I've got is, it basically has like examples of exactly what you need to put where. But if you file that with the county clerk, right? My stuff also comes with a certificate of service so you can serve it. And the rules that apply to how a defendant, right, just a normal person, has to serve a lawyer or another company are different. You could absolutely just FedEx it, or you could email it to them or what have you, where the lawyer can't, right? You have to be officially served. But you can say, hey, this was served this way, right? And if you do that, then the judge can issue a hearing. Right. And put an immediate stop to the wage garnishment, and then figure out exactly what happened. Right. Like, how did we go through with this? You said that everything was properly served. And now the lawyer's got to backpedal. Right. The lawyer, you know, because the lawyer didn't do it. Like, the lawyer,
I gotta work.
The lawyer, yeah, hired somebody. Right. They hired a process server or what have you. And process servers are a lot like bail bondsmen. Right. Is that they have to be registered. They've got to be licensed with the state, but you probably don't want to take one for dinner. Like, you wouldn't want one to know where you live. Right. These are not like the highest end type people. Right. Like, remember when Tony Stark gets served by the lady in Iron Man? That she's not showing up at your door. Okay.
It's not her.
No. Yeah. You're going to get like Dog the Bounty Hunter or something like that. You know, like it's just someone that is, it's an official court, you know, state license.
Yeah.
And that could be anybody, like anyone. It's almost like a notary, like anyone can apply for it. You know, you get paid per service, you know, but once that happens, you know, that now the lawyer has to start backpedaling and figuring out what happened, because at that point they're responsible for the improper service. right? It was their responsibility to serve you properly. If they outsource that to a process server or anything else, then it doesn't matter. Even if they've got a process server in their firm, right? Or if they've got someone in their firm that can do that, that it's the lawyer's responsibility. And that then rolls up onto the debt collector, right? Because ultimately, the lawyer is just the agent of the debt collector.
And the debt collector at that point can just choose to drop the suit.
And that happens a lot. That happens a lot.
Right. Just because you file the improper whatever.
Because now they're in trouble. It's a motion to vacate judgment.
Motion to vacate judgment because of improper service.
Because of improper service. Right.
Even if maybe there was an improper service, but if you file that, or you have to be able to prove that there was.
No. So here's the thing about court that a lot of folks get really confused is that you got sued. Okay. You don't have the burden of proof, right? The burden of proof is always on the plaintiff or the prosecutor, right? The plaintiff is the one in a civil suit that's doing the suing. The prosecutor is the cops. Right. If you're a criminal defendant, the prosecutors are cops. The burden of proof, and this is what folks they never understand when they're thinking, I got sued by a debt collector, that the burden of proof is not on you. Okay. The more you make a lawyer work for the burden of proof, right? Think about it, they only get paid a percentage of what they get. Right.
If and when they get it,
they only get paid a percentage. They haven't gotten paid anything. They are working this case for free. OK, at this point, at every point during the proceedings, during the court case, during the trial, during the discovery process, at the negotiation, that's all free. Right. The maximum they can get is a certain percentage of the judgment. Now, depending on how much you owe. Right, or how much they're claiming you owe, there is a point where it is the law of diminishing returns, right? Because say this lawyer normally gets $300 an hour. Even a bad lawyer gets $300 an hour, right? Good lawyers, $500, $600, $700 an hour.
Yeah.
Even a bad lawyer is going to get $250 or $300 an hour. If you owe $2,500, right, there's a point where there's no amount of money that they can get from you where they're not losing money. Right. There's, you know, because they can't recoup that. Right. People need to think about these types of things when they get sued. And people have over the last year or so, they've started getting sued for smaller amounts. I've seen $2,200 lawsuits. Right. I've seen $1,800 lawsuits. And at that point, if you just show up to court, the moment you show up to court, and it, a lot of times you don't even have to show up to court, the summons, when you get it, will tell you how you need to respond. It's either going to say you need to you can do one of two things. All right. It's either going to be one or the other for sure. Most of the time, the summons is going to tell you that you could do either or. One is going to be to show up at a certain time on a certain day. The other is going to be you need to just file a response to the complaint by a certain time. Right. You don't even have to show up to court. Okay. And at that point, then really all you have to do is file an answer. And just deny everything.
Your answer could just be the, you know, improper service.
But at that point, if you let's take this to the other side.
Well, no, because you got the summons. Never mind.
Right. If you got the summons, like when you're reading the summons,
it's not improper service. Right. Yeah. You're answering to the service.
If you got served improperly, if you're like wages are getting garnished or whatever, you file the motion to vacate, and immediately there's going to be action. Right. You might know about it right away, but the county clerk is going to be in communication with you now, and they're going to let you know when. And again, the reality now is that at some point, one way or another, either you're going to deal with it or you're not. If you're not going to deal with it, fine. Your wages are going to get garnished. If you're in, you know, Texas or North Carolina or Minnesota or one of those states that doesn't allow you to garnish, then you could get a bank levy or whatever. But you're going to deal with it at some point. The by far the best time to deal with it is pre-judgment.
So when you receive the sum, so we talked about the guy that got sued, didn't even know about it, and now he's having to kind of like, you know, tread water to get his head above water again. And we talked about how to do that. So now we're talking about the person who received the summons and now they got to do something with it. What's the best step for that person?
It's just to file an answer. So you need to read the summons because the summons is going to tell you what to do. Right. Either you need to show up. Most of the time, it's not going to be show up. Most of the time, it's going to be depending on the court. right? Most of the time, it's just going to be in regular state court, regular county court, right? Sometimes it could be, if it's a really small amount, you know, under $1,500 or whatever, it could be in small claims court. And small claims court is always going to make you go to court, right? Because it's like, that's the place where you get tickets done and all that kind of stuff too. But if it's a normal county court, then that's going to be decided by the judge's calendar. What's not happening is the judge is certainly not going to schedule 100 hearings on the same day, because if everyone were to show up for those 100 lawsuits that got filed, and he scheduled them all for, you got to all show up at this time, there's nothing they could be able to do with them anyway. Right. But judges know this. So they're going to tell you that you need to respond by a certain date. It's going to say it on the summons. It's going to tell you exactly how to do it. You need to file your answer.
And if you do show up to court, you don't need to come with an attorney. You can just come yourself.
Yep. You just come yourself. You don't even have to file an answer at that point. Right. Once you show up, the fact that you show up now puts everything in motion. And A, the lawyer is going to be pissed. Right. Because the lawyer knows that, for this person, I now have to do some work. And depending on how much this person knows, or depending on how much, because they don't even know how good the case is. It's not like the FBI. They did their
paperwork.
Yeah.
They're just pushing paper and hoping that something comes out.
That's it, right? If the FBI shows up at your door, or they show up with an indictment, you need to know that they've been investigating you for like 2 years, right? The FBI is not even going to talk to you until they've got their case tight. Right.
That's true.
This lawyer doesn't know anything about your account. He knows nothing. Right. Or she knows nothing. Right.
You're a number.
Right. You're just a file. You're just a manila file sitting on a pile, probably off to the left of his desk. These are the 100 that I filed over here.
Coffee stain on it.
Right. Over here in, Broward County or Miami County or Miami-Dade County or whatever. And he filed everything, and he knows what time, he knows when when everything is going to be due. Right. Because all the answers are going to have to be due on the same day. I would tell you that you need to wait until, 3 or 4 days before and answer then, because you don't want to give them any indication that you, ahead of time. Don't file immediately, but don't forget. But also don't file immediately. And if you can show up to court, right, if that is also an option, then do that, because at that point, it'll put the lawyer on the spot. Right. And
you normally you either show up to court or you file. They give you the choice. So if you just file, what are you filing?
So you're filing an answer to a complaint is what it is. And I've got this for free on my website.
And you have examples of this in a resource.
Give that out for free. Right. I've got larger guides that'll walk you through every step of the lawsuit process, from how to negotiate to knowing when you're beat, this kind of thing. What people need to realize in the lawsuit process is that, sure, if you can win and you can have it dropped, great. Right. What you're really trying to do is create as much leverage as possible, because that will give you like ammo during a negotiation. Right.
So that's why he's saying collect all the data, right. Keep record of everything, because you want that. You want to collect that.
All of it is leverage, right? The more leverage you have, and again, remember that I said that you're going to deal with it in one place or the other, right? Either you deal with it up front because you got properly served and you answer, or you didn't get properly served and you find out that you got a wage garnishment and then you file the motion to vacate. All this is going to do is bring you right back to here. That's it, right? Because at that point, you still have to roll, right? You still have to participate in it, or you could just let the garnishment run, right? That's terrible, because the judgment that you get, whatever the judgment is,
full amount plus more,
10 times more than you owe, right? Or 10 times more than you could have owed if you just participated in the process, right? Every time you have to go to court, every time you do a calendar call, every time you make the lawyer work, the case is worth less and less and less, and you can negotiate for less.
It seems like it's a common denominator here. When it comes to credit repair, the name of the game is leverage, right? All these dispute letters that you're sending and things are not coming off, they're not being deleted off the client's credit report. That's not necessarily a bad thing. That's all leverage that you're collecting later on so that when you do file, let's say, a CFPB complaint or you contact the attorney general, you have leverage, like thick file of all the dispute letters that weren't answered and all the responses that the credit bureau sent back. So the name of the game when the credit report is leverage, and it seems to me like what we're talking about now, if you're trying to defend yourself against a lawsuit and debt, leverage comes up again as the name of the
virtually
game.
Everything in the legal world is about leverage, right? And that's honestly kind of what you're doing, like you mentioned with credit repair, is litigation by mail, right? You're trying to, and if you're doing it right, you're creating a paper trail that could ultimately lead to litigation. I mean, you're doing litigation by mail. If they do something procedurally wrong, then you know. Remember, so an FDCPA complaint, every violation is a grant, right? You get multiple violations. You can prove multiple violations, and then all of a sudden, this $10,000-$12,000 debt that you owed could get completely wiped out because they don't want to. And again, they have to pay for all this. Like the
It's not like I'm going to discount your debt by the number of violations, right? It's like they're going to have to pay.
Yeah, they've got to pay it. You can we can settle, and I won't pursue these counterclaims if you wipe out my debt and remove this from my credit report, right? Remove the trade line, you know? And at that point, that could be very, very advantageous for you to do that, right? But yep.
So
all of
you
that-
file the response to the summons, and then you're back to now you're participating in a lawsuit. So your response that you're going to file could be a number of things. You're saying just deny everything. Deny everything, put the burden of proof on them because by law, it is on them. You're not lying. You just deny, like, hey, I don't
right.
know.
Well, so you can also do. You can also do affirmative defenses.
Did I speed, officer? I don't know. Right, the officer has to prove that you were speeding. Right. Like, I don't know. I wasn't looking at my speedometer. You're saying it is 87. Could have been 87. Could have been 86. I don't know. Right. So that's really kind of like what I'm gonna start using that.
Yeah. No. I mean, that's sort of what happens. Like,
that's a joke.
The other thing is there are affirmative defenses that you can use if you know right away that this is beyond the statute of limitations. Right. If
are they even allowed to sue if it's past the statute of limitations? Like, will the judge even allow that to happen?
Those are two different questions. You asked, will the judge allow it to happen? Yes, he'll allow the lawsuit to go through. Right. The judge doesn't,
even though they're legally not allowed to sue past the statute
of limitations.
Right.
That's right. The judge has no idea doesn't know anything about your case. That's it. The only thing the judge knows is I issued an order. Right, on a summons that I stamped that said you had to reply by a certain day. I don't know anything about
the judge
this
doesn't
case.
Know that, hey, I'm in Texas or Florida. The statute of limitations on open-ended accounts is 5 years. The date here looks like it's 6 years. They're not even doing all that. They're just stamp.
You,
here you
didn't,
go. The paperwork was filed properly. Great. Go for
you
it.
You didn't fight the lawsuit. So that's where some of that kind of comes into play. Man, if you got a judgment and you got your wages garnished on a case that was past the statute of limitations anyway, it's bad news. Like it's bad news for them. Like if you find out about
it,
for them,
because your countersuit on that is going to be insane.
But people don't know these kind of things because the first thing they do is unfortunately the same thing that a lot of folks were doing when they were getting like the final notice bills and things like that. They were just like, you know, kick it down the road. Right. I deal with it then. And they don't show up to court. And at that point, you've lost all your power. Right. The court can do barely anything. The lawyer knows nothing about your case. The judge knows nothing about your case. That's it. It got passed on to them. Debt collectors have never seen a debt collector provide the end date of the statute of limitations, the date of first delinquency. They don't know that kind of stuff.
So let's pause here for a second and talk about the statute of limitations that we're talking about, because this can be confusing to a lot of CROs. There are two types of statute of limitations, if you will. There's a allowed reporting period, which is where everybody says 7 years, right? After 7 years, it has to come off your credit report. That is a statute of limitations for how long the credit bureaus are allowed to report that data on your credit report. And that 7 year clock starts from date of first delinquency.
Now, here's what gets everyone. Like, you're exactly right. It's the date of first delinquency. For all of you that are listening, the date of first delinquency is not the first date that you missed a payment or whatever, because you might have missed a payment and then come back to good, right? Say you made double the payment or whatever the next time. So now you've gotten back to paid as agreed status. You're on time. Right. Date of first delinquency is the first date of a missed payment that ultimately led to the account getting charged off to where you never brought it back to even. right?
Correct.
Now, this could go wrong.
The date of first delinquency.
Yeah, you could be 30 days late. So say you're 30 days late, then all you do is you make the minimum payment from then on. Well, so now your account is still technically 30 days late because
you're rolling 30.
Right. And so even though you're making payments, right, the date of first delinquency will never reset. Ever.
Because you never got current again.
Make,
so the date of first delinquency is the date that you were late and you never got caught up
again. You never got caught up again.
Not the first, because by the name, date of first delinquency, you would incorrectly assume that it was the first time that you were ever delinquent. It's 7 years from now. No, it's the last time that you were first delinquent and never got caught up again. And that's when that 7 year clock starts. But that's for the statute of limitations for the reporting period of 7 years. That's for all accounts, unless it's a bankruptcy. And if it's a closed account, right?
Right.
Closed accounts normally stay in report for 10 years. Bankruptcies would be 5 years, sometimes 12 years, 10 years, depending on the bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So that's one statute of limitations. The other one is the allowed time that the debt collector or the creditor has to sue you to legally pursue the debt. And that varies per state and per account type. An installment account in Texas or an open-ended account in Texas may have different statute of limitations years. And there are some states that have a statute of limitations of 15 years to where you can get sued for that debt. So guess what? After 7 years, it's been removed from your credit report. But for another 8 years more, you can still get sued for that debt.
Yeah.
Right?
So in Texas, everything is 4 years. Right. And I think Florida is similar. Like in Texas, everything, no matter what type of debt it is, it's 4 years. There are states that have the different type of debt has a different type of different statute of limitations, right? It could be 10 years, which is longer than it can be on your credit report, right? So it could already be gone and then you could still get sued from it, right? Very, very rarely, most of the time, right? Most of the time when you see when you get sued for a debt that's not on your credit report, it is going to be beyond the statute of limitations. It's just someone out there, you know, filing it like a junk debt buyer trying to find
like zombie debt.
Right, zombie debt
is what we call
right.
it. Zombie debt.
And most of the time, they've already done things they shouldn't do. Like they've called you and threatened lawsuits, and they threaten to call the, you know, like we're going to call the cops and have that kind of. And people buy that stuff, right? Which they cannot do. You know
how consumers are called like in this setting? They're called the least sophisticated consumer. They're not just called consumers. The terminology used in the setting of litigation.
Absolutely.
The least sophisticated consumer.
Right. So,
right. And why are they called that? Well, because they really are least sophisticated because they're not educated on this process. They didn't go to law school. They don't know this stuff. They didn't study debt defense like Dustin the Credit Geek.
Right. But that term, like least sophisticated consumer, is actually in your benefit because what it's saying is that when the court and the case files, like these case laws that are being created, when a debt collector is doing something or what have you, then it has to be accessible to that least sophisticated consumer, right? The least sophisticated type of person in legal terms and in credit law and that kind of thing needs to be able to understand what is going on. Right. Without any sort of training or anything like that, which is where like being able to defend yourself has a lot of advantages. Right. If you were to go out and get a lawyer because you got sued, then you already know what it is. It's going to be a couple thousand dollars for the lawyer just to respond. Right. Every court appearance is going to be $1,500, $2,000. Every hour that they work is going to be a couple hundred bucks, you know, and it could rack up really, really fast. And that's the math that people are doing in their head. Like they get this lawsuit and they say,
that's why they freak out. They don't know what to do. So end up doing nothing.
They end up doing
nothing. They get analysis paralysis because they're like, okay, well, what do I do? I don't know what to do. And then boom, they're stuck. And then next thing they know, their wages.
They don't understand that the burden of proof is absolutely is the responsibility of whoever's doing the suing.
So we talked about, they could just respond to the summons as one of the options. What if, can they pick up the phone and call the debt collector, the creditor, once they receive the summons and say, hey, I just got this. Looks like it's from you guys. Can we negotiate this before any of this goes any further? Or does an action still need to be taken by the consumer regarding that summons?
Yes and yes, right? Like I would say that you still need to respond because you don't want to, what is the debt collector's job, right? The debt collector has one job, collect money. Right. If they can, how many times has a debt collector said, hey, listen, all you got to do is pay, you know, $5 and we'll stop collection activity, blah, 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 blah. Right. What are they doing? They know that they're resetting the statute of limitations.
Resetting the statute of limitations.
Right. They know that they're doing those things. So it would not be beyond it, what I can imagine a debt collector would be willing to do to say, hey, yeah, let's negotiate. right? Don't even worry about it, and let the court date go by without actually coming to a negotiation with you, right? Coming actual to a settlement, and you know, letting the court date go by and getting a judgment on you anyway, and just say, oh, well, we weren't able to come to any kind of settlement.
So they will take the little bit of money, say that we'll settle it, and then reset the statute of limitations, and then not drop the lawsuit, which is still active, and now the customer got the bad end of the stick twice.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So I would say,
so don't contact the debt collector, the creditor.
No,
at this
if you point. Contact if you got
the
anyone,
go through the proper channels and just go to the clerk of the court and respond.
Just like with the power of attorney, right? Like a CROs, a lot, you know, I do. We send a limited power of attorney that we let the credit bureaus, we let any creditors know that we're officially representing this consumer, right? In their endeavor to basically, you know, get their credit report right. Right. There's some questionable things that they've retained us to represent them in this. So we send out a power of attorney. When a debt collector hires an attorney, now the attorney has all the power of that same debt collector. If you are going to try to negotiate with anybody, you negotiate with the lawyer. Right. What? Because the lawyer is doing the economic math
in your head.
Right. Yeah. The lawyer is doing the economic math and saying, OK, well, let's see how much I could get without also doing any work. Right. Because at that point, they don't have to work. When you show up to court, now they've got to do work.
And you can always negotiate with the attorney later. That
Absolutely.
Doesn't have to be your first response. Your first response should always be respond to the summons or show up to court. Show them that you're willing to play ball, because that gives you more leverage to be able to negotiate an even lower amount if you even have to negotiate a payment at all, right, with them.
So, and here's the thing is that the discovery process is where you can really start racking up leverage. Right. Because the discovery process, for everyone that doesn't know, is where and this happens in a criminal case, too. But in the civil world, like if once the judge sets a hearing, then the discovery process starts. Right. And there are different things that you can ask for. There are requests for admissions. Right. There's a document that is done. I've got a whole section just about this because it's so fascinating. You could basically say we need you to admit that this debt is beyond the statute of limitations. Like, you know, so. The thing about it is that at any point, if the other side doesn't respond, like request for admissions, then they're deemed accepted, right? So, right. So the lawyer is definitely going to start sending out requests for admissions. They want you to admit this debt is absolutely yours. Admit that you owe the debt. Admit that you have no intention of paying the debt. Blah 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 blah. And all you have to do.
And then if you don't respond, that's admission of guilt because you didn't respond.
That's right.
So you can do the same with
right.
them.
Right. Now people don't know this. Right. So they this packet,
I don't
this
know.
Packet comes. They have no idea what to do. Normally, the packet's going to have the discovery process is generally going to have three different portions. It's going to be interrogatories, which are just questions. Then there's going to be requests for admissions, which is where the lawyer is requesting that you admit certain facts. Mm-hmm. Right. And those facts become evidence. Right, they're submitted into the court as evidence. Then there's going to be requests for productions of documentation. Right now, in both of these, in interrogatories, in requests for admissions, and requests for productions, the plaintiff has great leeway. You can request you can do the same thing in like requests for admissions. You can do the same thing to them that they're going to do to you. Right. Admit that the debt is beyond the statute of limitations. Admit that I don't actually owe this debt. Admit that you can't even prove that this debt is mine. And I've got a list of like 150 different requests for admissions that have been successful in court cases before. And again, if they don't deny all of these requests for admissions, then they are deemed accepted. Right, they're deemed accepted and then entered into evidence. When it comes to requests for productions, think about all the things that we've all wanted to ask a debt collector for. I need to see the original agreement. Right, I need to see the original purchase agreement. Oh, you don't have it. I need to see a monthly accounting history of this account with every credit and every payment.
From its inception, from the time the account was open till present day.
You can also request to depose certain people at the original creditor, at the debt collector, at any debt collector that's owned the debt up until then.
Wow.
Right. Because someone has to have personal knowledge of this account. Someone's got to have it. Right. And think about what's happening. Where, like, you know where Wells Fargo is based? Wyoming. You're in Miami. You're close to Florida, right? Yeah. If someone in Florida gets sued, then someone from Wells Fargo, they could ask to depose someone from Wells Fargo. They can the person that someone who has personal knowledge of me opening the account, right? Someone has personal. I need someone in the training department. I'd like to depose someone in the training department so we can go through the training of the employees that are dealing with accounts like mine.
Dude, that's insane. So you start asking for all this stuff, and then they're like, "We ain't got time or money."
Right, because now you got to fly in witnesses and things like that. Like, you've got to be able to prove. Like, the debt collector has to be able to prove a unbroken chain of ownership of the account all the way back to the original creditor. Right, these are things that you are allowed to ask for. Right, and if they get denied, it needs to be for a damn good reason. It can't just be because, hey, well, you know what? We'd rather not pay for the flight out here. Right, so you could ask to depose all of these witnesses, not because you actually want to learn things from them. Like, I've got guys that say, hey, this is what you want to be asking for and things like that. It's not that. What you're doing is you are racking up a bill, basically, that they have to pay. Right, they've got to pay to fly things out. If they can't produce a document, if they can't produce a full accounting history, right? How can you even say that these payments were late? How can you say that I owe a balance at all? Right? You can't approve.
And it's not like the dispute letters where they just send the last statement and they say that that's proof.
No.
Like, this is actual legal discovery paperwork they have to produce.
All the things that you see people in social media having videos of and all this kind of stuff that they say you can ask for that you can't actually ask for because what the law says counts as legal validation from a debt collector, right? Which is not much. All those things you can actually ask for in the litigation process. Right. You've got a ton of leverage. The more you make them work, right, the more you are going to find holes because they're going to be there. You're going to find holes in their case. And if you can start putting together a half decent case of what they, this is the thing that they should have, but they don't have this stuff. Right. This is what, you know, any of that, the more leverage that you create, the lower that settlement is ultimately going to be. Right. And again, every time the lawyer has to go to court, they're losing money. They're not getting paid because ultimately they're only going to get a percentage of whatever the settlement is. Right. So
anyway,
so
it's $5,000. They're not getting $5,000. No, they're getting a percentage of that. The original creditor still has to get paid.
Yeah.
Right. And everybody has to get paid because unless the debt collector bought the debt, but either way, they have to make the money back of what they paid for the debt. So very easily you can get this stuff to really be very cheap to get rid of, or even nothing.
You know, 10 cents on the dollar, 12 cents on the, so the average is 12 cents on the dollar. So they bought, you know, this $1,000 debt, this $10,000 debt for maybe $600, $700, right? At that point, you know, they're going to be good to, you know, you can get it down to where they just don't lose money on it. If you can start finding, areas where they're actually created violations, then, and you've got some counterclaims and things like that, that gives you a lot more power. Right, a lot more power in those. Now, the thing about it, the thing to know going in, and this is what I stress all throughout my guides and all that, is that the whole point, like if you can find counterclaims, if you can get the whole thing dropped, then great, right? And then that's not, lawsuits get dropped probably 40% of the time, roughly 40% of the time, right? Because again, everything is a economical mathematic decision, right? There, you know, how much. When does it become the point of diminishing returns? And when is it going to be to where I'm losing money on this now? And no matter what happens, I can't actually make any money on this, right? They're not looking at, just screw this bastard. They don't care about you. They don't care about you. They don't care about your credit. All they care, it's just dollar signs, right? And so the moment it gets close to the red, then they start making those decisions and things can get dropped fast at that point, especially if you're in like the lower dollar amount lawsuits, which are happening a lot more lately, right? And again, I've got guides for all this. Another thing that a lot of consumers don't know about, and this has become like a buzzword in credit repair lately, is arbitration. Okay, arbitration is fascinating, and I think that. I think over the next few years, I think every credit repair company, every company that is actually involved in helping out a consumer with their credit needs to learn it. They need to understand it, right? Because It is a way to kind of force litigation that that a lot of folks aren't using. Most 95% of consumer credit card agreements have an arbitration clause. Now, you have to understand why the arbitration clause is there. The arbitration clause is not there to protect you. Okay, it's to protect the bank. Now, it means that if you were to sue Wells Fargo or Chase or Capital One or whoever, there's an arbitration clause in there that says that instead of litigation, we will agree to binding arbitration. Right? Now, arbitration is basically like litigation outside of court that there's no jury or anything like that. It's just a mediator.
We can do a whole episode right. about arbitration but here's, next.
Yeah. So, but here's the point of that is that the company, like the creditor or the debt collector, if that agreement had an arbitration agreement, then the debt collector doesn't just buy the debt. They buy the file, right? They buy the file. They buy the contract. They buy the agreement. They have to abide by everything in the original agreement. The debt collector can't, and this is the first debt collector, second, third, fourth. They can't just change the name of the game. They can't just change the rules. You know, if the consumer signed a purchase agreement or signed a credit agreement with Amex that says these things, this is what we're going to do, then the debt collector can't just come along, wipe that out and say, no, this is how we do things. No, you bought the whole file, meaning that you now agree to take the place of this original creditor in this agreement, right?
Right. They can't change the agreement.
No.
They have to abide by the original
right.
agreement.
And this is where the whole BS, and you've probably seen this, I know you've seen this on social media. Well, once a debt collector buys it, then I don't owe it anymore. No. Oh, yes, you do. You know, like that defense has literally been laughed out of court probably 24 times in the last 2 years because of social media. You know, someone will go, like, they'll get sued. Then they'll go and they'll say, no, you know, the debt collector bought it. I don't owe it anymore. Oh, yeah, you do. Like, they're buying the entire file and they're inserting themselves into the place of that original creditor, right? Now they own the file.
And it sucks, right? It sucks that there's so much bad information out there and consumers even to get their hands on that too. It's like, it's what you just said. The debt collector bought the debt. You assume, oh, I never had an agreement with the debt collector. I don't owe you nothing. Well, no. That's not how it works. The debt collector bought the original contract. They now own the original contract. And you did sign the original contract. So you do
in
owe,
the terms of
right?
conditions.
It doesn't matter who owns right. the debt. The debt is the legal rights to that debt is owned now by whoever purchased the debt. You do owe Midland Funding. You do owe portfolio, right? It's not.
Yeah, you own. And
you're going to get laughed out of court, like you said.
And it has. Like, people have done that. And it, you know, there are always people that are representing themselves because no lawyer is going to make that argument, right? And it gets laughed out of court every single time. It really is. But the point is that it's still the arbitration clause is still binding, right? And this is something that a lot of folks don't know about. They think that if they get sued, then that might be it. Well, I'm going to have to go to court. There's going to be a jury and all that kind of stuff. Maybe not, right? You could do arbitration, right? The arbitration clause is there to protect the bank because they don't want the expense of a...
You can use it to your benefit, even though
right,
it's there to protect
the bank. It goes both ways. So the bank will sue you, right? The bank is not just going to file arbitration. They're going to sue you, hoping that you don't realize that the arbitration clause in the agreement goes both mm-hmm. ways. And then all you have to do is file a motion to compel arbitration, right? And then the judge is going to, there's not even going to be a question about it.
So from what I'm hearing, man, there's so many different ways that a consumer or anybody can defend themselves when it comes to this. And dude, what you've done like in an hour and 25 minutes is you've taken probably less because we went on a few tangents, but you've taken what appears to be like this seven-headed monster that's out to get you and you made it into this tame little kitty cat. Right? Like this whole debt defense stuff.
The one thing that I'll never say is that you're going to get out of this scot-free. You're not, right? Like you racked up the debt. You had the car, you know, whatever. Like there, you know, you agree.
Even morally or ethically,
right.
Like you got to have
right.
that.
Yeah. And I know you do too. I've got a clause in my agreement that says like, you know, I let them know in the agreement, hey, just because a debt is not reporting on your credit report does not mean that it is not a legal debt. It is the position of Rocket Financial Services that it is every consumer's moral and legal obligation to pay all their legally owed debt. right? I tell folks that all the time, you know, so I'll never tell someone you're going to get out scot-free. What I will tell you is that there's a lot of leverage out there that if you just know, basically like pulling back the curtain in Oz, right? If you can just see past the curtain a little bit and you take the time to do just a little bit of research and figure out what's about to happen, you know, like you can get off with way less than what you thought you were going to get. Like you don't have to get all your wages garnished and all those kind of things. Like you can create a settlement, and in your settlement, you can say that we're not going to have a judgment, right? You can settle with the thing and say that, you know, and that's what you want. I tell folks that in there, because if they've got a judgment in hand, then at any point you miss a payment and they can go right to wage garnishing your wages or whatever, because they've got the judgment. So when you're negotiating, I've got negotiating tactics and all that kind of stuff in there that, you know, when's the best time, what kind of things you want to make sure that you get, right? You want to get a no judgment clause in that settlement agreement. And at that point, like the lawyer doesn't care. Like the lawyer does not care, right? Because what they're getting paid on is the dollar amount that gets inked into that negotiation settlement.
Is there anything that we didn't touch on that is like very important that we got to talk about that you didn't get?
No, I don't think so. Like, so I've got a bunch of guides at rocketdebtdefense.com. The main thing is just you cannot ignore it. You can't, right? You're going to pay it one way or the other. If you engage in it, if you can just put your, if you just put yourself out there and you're willing to learn a little bit, then you can get out at a way better price. You could possibly get the entire thing dismissed, right? Like in arbitration, we were talking about that earlier. They've got to pay for arbitration, right? Arbitration is going to cost them $5,000, $5,500, you know, $6,000. If your debt is only $3,500 and you file a motion, I can tell you how many times I've seen the lawsuit get dismissed, right? Because you filed a motion to compel arbitration and they were going to have to pay more to go to arbitration than the full debt was worth anyway. Right. A lot of times, you know, little credit card companies, that happens all the time.
RocketDebtDefense.com. Do you have resources there for CROs, for credit repair businesses? Do you have anything on there that they can access to learn more about everything we just talked about, or even to help, you know, give their clients direction?
No, I wrote it in just like I wrote everything in writing for consumers. Right. But all the information,
the CRO can take that information, that knowledge, and then just pass it on to their customers.
I've got 50 and these are motions, like real motions that have been written by a real attorney. Like I worked with an attorney to develop this stuff, right? Everything that I wrote got sent through and edited by a attorney that does debt defense. Like this is what they do. Right. And there's 50 motions in there that have absolute examples of this is when this would work. Right. This is when you would want to file this. These are the situations. This is what you want to do. This is what you don't want to do. This is where you need to list everything. And so if a CRO is willing to just go through and read it. And again, this is one of those things that I think that CROs need to understand, because your clients are going to go through this and you need to have a resource that you can point them to.
You need to educate yourself. But also,
them. Like they're not coming to you for legal advice. They know you're not a lawyer. They just want to know a little bit about like, what am I facing? That's what they want to know. What am I facing? Right. If you got to go and get, you know, the first time when you're a kid, you go get stitches or you go get a tooth pulled or whatever. All you're really asking your mom is like, is it going to hurt? Is it going to hurt? Same thing. Like that never goes away. They really just want to know, like, what am I facing? What is this about to look like? You know, am I, they're going to throw me in jail? Or are they going to make me sell my house? Like what is about to happen? Consumers, you know, they just want to know what's about to happen, right? When they get a subpoena, it's a legal document that has your name on top and it's got verses next to it, right? Midland Funding or Wells Fargo or whoever versus Dustin Ball, right? And it becomes this very adversarial thing. And you're like, crap, how am I going to take on Wells Fargo? Or how am I going to take on Santander? Or how am I going to take on, you know, and it's, I don't want to say that I think that those things are by design, right? But that's the effect that it has in most people. Like if you've never been arrested or anything like that, then there's something like seeing, you know, the state of whatever versus you know, your name.
That is,
you know,
scary.
Yeah. Like, or for those poor people that have gone through federal court, like the United States of America versus so-and-so, you know, like it's just intimidating and it becomes very adversarial and it becomes very like right now, right? You know, because you've been kicking it down the, you know, you've been kicking it down the road. You've been putting it out of your mind, actively putting it out of your mind for a long time. And now here it is, right? And you have to make like this snap decision on, am I going to engage with it or am I going to just ignore it? And if CROs in that moment, right, they can, because they've done a little bit of research, right, to be able to understand what the lawsuit process looks like and what's going to happen. You know, if there's some, you know, if they can just do a little bit of due diligence on their end to learn a little bit about it, then they don't have to play lawyer or anything like that. But they can tell you like, hey, yeah, you're going to go, this is what's going to happen. It's not that scary. And you can actually, you can help the client out by helping them to understand that it's not this giant, scary thing and that everything is going to be okay. Right. The reason I made the resources is because, yeah, like there was truly nothing out there. Right. And there's only so much if you haven't done like all the research and you haven't worked with the attorneys and everything. And I don't expect a bunch of CROs to go out and do this. I'm just that guy, right? Like I'm the nerd. So if you haven't done that, then the only thing that you can say is go get a lawyer. And sure, that's not bad advice, but you aren't actually helping them. Like what you're going to help them, you're helping them when you can give them the confidence to walk into the courtroom or to answer the lawsuit and know that, hey, no matter how uncomfortable this is going to be way better for you in the end than, you know, getting your wages garnished for way more than you could have gotten out of it in the first hand, right? Like that's the worst kind of math is, hey, just leave it alone. And even though you owed, yeah, I can see it. Like you owed $3,000 at the end of the, you know, when they charge it off, they're suing you for $9,000. You know, and if you don't show up to court, then you're gonna have to pay every dollar robbery. Of that $9,000.
Like this stuff, it's literally legal robbery. It blows my mind. And I think that as CROs, when we get customers that find themselves in that position, I think even as just human beings, not even as their credit repair company, just as a human being to another human being, if I have the knowledge of this stuff, man, as a human being, I just want to let you know that, hey, I cannot allow you to think that they can get away with the stuff that they're about to get away with and that you have rights. And here's, you know, how you can kind of navigate these rough waters, you know. RocketThatDefense.com can get all the stuff there, all the resources they created, ebooks, motions, and all that stuff.
You know me, like if it's not overdone, I didn't do it. Yeah. Right. And so I go into, especially when it comes to like the motions and things like that, I researched a ton of different cases to find all different sort of really diverse situations that consumers like found themselves in and different things that happened in their cases to be able to come up with this list of motions, right? So if there was a motion filed by a consumer in one of the hundreds and hundreds of cases that I reviewed, it's in there, right? But it all comes down to like these 50, right? And really only 20 of them, really, right? These other 30 were some of these like outlying cases that someone might find themselves in at some point. But for the most of the time, like everything is fairly straightforward and you're just filing all these things to create all this leverage. And before trial is set, before any court in the discovery process, you know, they're going to start wanting to negotiate with you. Right. And the more weapons that you can kind of gather, the better you can do at negotiating it down. You can get a monthly payment that's down to like nothing. Right. You can make sure that you don't get a judgment. And, you know, that's going to be way better for you than getting 25% of your paycheck taken from before you even get to see it. Because that's all pre-tax money. You know what I'm saying? Like you're getting taxed on the whole thing, but they're taking it before you even see it.
Man, you are a saint for doing all this research and sharing all that with us and creating all these resources that you created at RocketThatDefense.com. So, dude. Thank you so much for doing that. And I know you do it out of the kindness.
Always.
I know it's out of the kindness of your heart. I know it's also because you enjoy it. You're a geek when it comes to this stuff. But to share it with us, to share with the credit junkies, it's awesome. And thank you so much for sharing all that knowledge and all the resources that you have with us and, you know, with everybody that's listening or watching. So I really appreciate you, man. I know we're probably, I don't know, over an hour and a half in. So we'll cut it now. We can have more conversations about this another time. But you know, if you're listening, you didn't see what happened. My power went out while we were recording the episode, and I had to jump back on my laptop, my hotspot. So my camera looks different. The sound will probably not look different to you or sound different because it's all going to get edited anyway. But if you're watching on YouTube and you see that it changed, that's what happened. So I apologize for any inconvenience there. So if you're a CRO, or whether you've been established or you're just getting started, or even if you're a consumer that wants to be more educated about this whole, how can you defend yourself against debt, or how you can help your clients defend themselves against these debt lawsuits, rocketdebtdefense.com is where I'd recommend you'd go, because you'll be learning from the guy that did a lot of research on this. And if you're thinking about starting your credit repair company, or you're already up and running and you want to make $10,000 a month in as little as 100 days guaranteed, we have an awesome training program for you. Just go to creditrepairjunkies.com/go and you can get more information about that there. Dustin, thank you for taking the time. I know you're busy.
Always.
So I really appreciate you taking the time to come in and, you know, chop it up with me and educate our community.
No, man, I appreciate it. Like, I appreciate you having me on. You know, one of the things that you and I really both have in common is that we want as much as possible for other people, right, to be the best that they can be, right, in their families, in their businesses, for their clients. And that as much as we can educate ourselves, is that, I mean, that's our obligation. That's our responsibility, to educate ourselves so we can be the best that we can be, small improvements every day. Once we do that, we can just raise the reputation of the industry as a whole. Right. And so I encourage you guys, like, my contact information is on the website. If you have any questions about anything, you want to talk kind of one-on-one, I also have lists of a lot of debt defense attorneys that are happy to review your clients' files and things like that, to like their summons and all that kind of stuff, so they can see if there's anything specific that they need. So you guys let me know. Bruce, as always, man, I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity just to chat with you. And I know we'll talk again soon.
For sure. All right. Let me give them your cell phone number. I'm just kidding. Thank you, Dustin.
Oh, yeah. I used to do that at CreditCon.
RocketDebtDefense.com if you want to learn more about the benefits. Thank you, Doug. Appreciate you.